Welcome back to Disc 2, production commentary for The Return of the King. The sequence was originally in the theatrical cut. We filmed it, and of course, just to prove how egalitarian Peter is, he cut the sequence in which he has a very big cameo.
And there are actually numerous production cameos here.
Yes, and this is also the crew's favorite sequence, because somebody got to do what everybody had been wanting to do all the way through the film, which was shoot the bloody director.
Ooh. This scene is full of cameos. You've got Peter Jackson in it, Richard Taylor, Gino Acevedo.
And Rick Porras.
Rick Porras,
the co-producer.
Oh, yes.
Rick, where are you?
In fact, you're about to see Rick Porras scream right there.
I just want to know, do you guys think, give me your honest opinion, but do you think that the scene is better, for the theatrical cut, it was better to cut out that close-up of my reaction shot? What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, better. That's what I thought.
Here we are now in the tunnel she loves cave.
I don't think I want to.
This tunnel sequence with Frodo rushing through the tunnels was one of those sequences you could play any way. There were some lovely shots filmed. One of the earlier passes at the scene I thought was actually quite good. I mean, it was one of the passes that we did before Pete came in, and I actually reckon it was a bit long, but it was actually quite good. I think it was a bit more edgy. I think we ended up, I don't know whether we actually ended up with the, I always felt we could have been a bit more edgy with the scene, a bit more scary. But I think Peter does himself, he always, and that's why he shot the scene, because he wanted to, he just imagined this is what it'd be like. Spider to be sort of just appear in the background, just the little legs poking out. Because he always imagined when he was a kid, that's what he used to notice. He'd see them tucked away in between a rock, and he used to see the little legs. And he wanted to make sure that happened in the scene. So there's a lot of back and forth went between the animators to actually get exactly what he wanted.
It's sticky.
There's a lot of patching that we had to do because the sets, as they were shot, weren't quite what Peter wanted to see once he started to put the sequence together. So we shot several component elements that could be used to just expand the set.
A lot of Shelob's Tunnel is based on John Howe's original paintings, all this pitted, kind of almost rotting, kind of feeling honeycomb rock. Feels really decrepit and ancient.
I really felt strongly that this Shelob's Cave should feel very just naturalistic and real. So I spent a fair amount of time torturing Bo, who was cutting all these water drips, making sure they were all in sync, and you know, just wanting to feel the slime and the wetness and the dankness of it all.
Which has the overall effect that once we finally meet the spider, it makes the spider much creepier because your brain has already put you into like a real cave.
And
it isn't playing as a fantasy, it's playing as a documentary type of the moment, you know.
Right.
This is another key deviation from the books here, in that Shelob and Shelob's Lair was a feature of the Two Towers book, and here you see it in the Return of the King film. But I think the feeling was that Two Towers had enough going on that you couldn't possibly, slam Shelob into it. But it actually works quite well here. It did present a challenge with The Return of the King because you had so much great material that had been saved that needed to be, one needed to find a way to work it in. A notable piece of key trivia here is that, you know, the gift-giving scene in Fellowship of the Ring, which was, you know, severely shortened and truncated for the theatrical version, but nonetheless kept Frodo getting the file of Galadriel precisely so that he would have it at this crucial moment two films later in The Return of the King. One could never lose the gift-giving scene entirely in the Fellowship theatrical version, simply to be certain that people would know it here. And just to be certain, we reprise Galadriel's line, you know, gift-giving line here, you know, on the soundtrack, just to be certain that everyone remembers.
Our most beloved star.
May it be a light for you in dark places.
Oh, right. I forgot about Sheila. That's a whole other character.
Sheila.
Forgot about her.
Was not. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, you know, it's a science fiction, fantasy, documentary, Tolkien. You know, it's everything. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare creature.
For the look of the thing, we had the Shelob head competition where they had all the workshop guys. Basically, they had a competition where they made their interpretation of Shelob, and Peter sort of went through and picked one. We had about 10 different variations. We sort of knew what the body was, but getting that head to basically, you know, it was this head that couldn't move at all, but that had to give emotion, you know, and just by its staticness of its look. And then, you know, he wanted a little bit of a decrepit look, so we sort of gave one side a little paralyzed, sagging side to it, so it wasn't an equal face. We sort of drooped one down, and
so she's really asymmetrical and covered with pustules and carbuncles and things. Mm. And also, she's got a stinger, which spiders don't have.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. That's the business end is up here, not back there.
This is just amazing. When the scene was cut, we had no Shelob in there. It was all figuring out, you know, the length of the shots and what Shelob's going to be doing. Peter was very definite with the animators how he wanted Shelob to react and sort of work in conjunction with Frodo falling and just pushing out the light. And it was just as his shots started coming through, it was just amazing. They were getting better and better. It was getting really scary, really making sense.
Pete really wanted to have a feel of a New Zealand tunnel web, not to be confused with the Australian New South Wales funnel web. But a lot of people working on the spider hadn't seen one, so I have a couple of these near my house, so I actually had to dig one out. And that was absolutely bloody terrifying, because I'm a bit of an arachnophobe, and I went through the... had to dig it out with a coat hanger out of this hole in the ground. And the thing came out, and it was... Oh man, I'm sure it was like four times bigger than I was expecting. And I just had the jitters. And I brought it in to show it to Pete just to make sure that it was the one that he kind of wanted to, the kind of spider that he really wanted Shelob to feel like. And it was, so that was good. I didn't have to go dig out another one.
The sequence of Gollum attacking Frodo outside the cave is an example where we did use the on-set motion capture, and it worked pretty successfully in here. So most of the motion capture data gave us a really strong basis for what we were working with. The thing about motion capturing a character like Gollum that is difficult is that Gollum is differently proportioned than Andy. So whereas Andy and Frodo work against each other and you have all of this contact that's real, Gollum doesn't fit Andy's body. His limbs are different sizes and different proportions. His neck is longer. His eyes are in a different place. So you have to reanimate him to make him look like he was actually in there with Elijah. You can't actually just take the motion capture and plug it in. It won't work. He'll be looking above his head and his elbows will be sticking out too far and his hands will be going off of his neck. It won't actually fit if you do it that way. But the motion capture on set really gave us something nice to start with in this scene.
So here we just see a little tiny piece of built set, and everything else there is miniature. That's a really nice example of expanding a very small piece of live action to create the huge sense of space. So build a foreground piece and then an extended background piece, and so they hook up to the edge of the built set.
This was on stage, and in fact, this was shot on what became, in post-production, our miniature stage.
It's really a tribute to the whole greens department, because it really matches wonderfully that sort of Flanorky paradise, you know, kind of like greenery.
This moment here, this was always in the script.
Yeah.
Frodo was actually in sort of in the situation of whether he was going to go ahead on his own. And this actually had to pull him back on track again. It was a good way of moving him forward. Was glad you'll come back and say, yes, he's got a job to do.
It's really neat that Galadriel sort of, she's got a voice in her head, because the dialogue changed quite significantly.
Yes.
We couldn't get Galadriel back.
It was just as well that was all that. It's over. Yes.
We have probably one of the most extensive horse libraries now after these movies in the history of the world. Our approach to doing horses is has been to record actual horses doing all the movements as specifically as we can get them on, you know, on the right surfaces. We have recordings of, you know, huge groups of horses, which is fairly rare.
The production recorders, in fact, we're also recording wild effects of the horses for us as well.
Yeah, we're well covered in the horse effects department.
We had one editor whose sort of primary job was the horses, and so he pretty much cut horses for films 2 and 3, which meant that he basically knew the library really, really well. And so there wasn't as much time spent searching things because he basically knew, in fact, what he had, his palette. And so it meant that there was a certain consistency in the way the horses were handled, which was good for the overall sound of the film, but also in other practical ways, it meant that the mixer, when he was doing effects pre-dubs, it was the same layout for his horses every reel. It was just a more efficient way of actually of sort of doing it.
Of course, he never wants to have to edit another horse in his life.
Yeah, this is true, but he was so good at it.
This little scene actually never ever got anywhere near being in the feature.
Yeah, this scene was not contemplated in any theatrical cut, maybe just because there wasn't time to contemplate it.
Annie and I originally cut it way back, and then it was recut with Fran over in the UK, this recut of the scene. It never actually got into the feature. It was never even thought of going to the feature. It's quite a nice little sequence, actually. It's a nice little bit more character stuff with Mary.
So Grand only existed as a miniature, a very large miniature, and it couldn't carry its own weight on its wheels. So whenever you see it moving, it's supported by a big frame, and then the wheels are being moved mechanically with motors underneath, because the wheels could really just there for show. But we actually did smash the gate with it.
And Grand was an actually beautiful miniature piece that was, not sure the scale that was built in, it was huge.
Yeah, even in miniature it was huge.
Yeah.
It was car-sized. Yeah. As a miniature.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the size of like maybe an old Chevy Impala.
And just the idea of seeing this enormous ironclad snout smashing through the gate and shattering it all to pieces. We were looking forward to that for 3.5 years, four years. Finally got to do it.
Thus have I walked.
This is one of the great things about Lord of the Rings. I mean, amid all the ton of stuff that's going on, we're still tapping into the mythology that's under, you know, the story, the subtext, the themes, all the intimate beats. And that there is a story going on about the return of the king, the flowering of the Tree of Gondor, which is foreshadowing that Aragorn is making his way here and perhaps will make it in time.
So is the significance of the tree explained that well in the films? You know, obviously it's a symbol of the House of Elendil, that if the tree dies, it basically sort of signifies the death of Gondor. It's the death of the line of kings.
Yeah, just like if you go to the Tower of London and the ravens are no longer there, that's supposed to symbolize the fact that the English monarchy is over. Of course, they've got those ravens that they tied to the ground.
This was a whole sequence that, of going off to the Hallows. That's right. Here, the Hallows. No
long. This is a great set. It was in what we call B stage. It was basically an old warehouse just linked up to the large stage, A stage that we had built. And it was perfect for these kind of long shots because the Artemarion could build a nice long set that didn't have to be very wide.
There's a great example of Grand, the miniature of Grand with digital characters dropped in to give you a sense of the scale. And when you see that shot, you think, wow, that is really a big piece of machinery. That's sort of one of the most telling shots in this whole sequence. Of course, all that flame is put in digitally. That's the other thing. It's a beautiful job of flame matching.
Peter added this sequence sort of in the...
Quite late, yeah.
It was interesting because when he turned it over, he said, oh, here's a sequence. I'd like to put trolls and wargs and, in, you know, big battles with trolls. But they're optional. If you want to do it, you can go ahead. If you don't want to, don't worry about it. They're like, what does optional mean? You know, we walked out of there going, optional? What? who's going to take the option, you know? So we ended up putting everything in.
Yeah.
I think like in a month or two, this came in and out.
Yeah.
It was very quick.
Fortunately, the humans they were squashing had armor on, and they were a little bit easier to turn into CG guys.
No, I actually think that's cool the way Pete just sort of throws those things in. You know, later on we see shots through streets, and you see a troll in the background, and he doesn't make a meal out of it, but it just, you know, fills the frame.
Oh, you gotta love that. That's actually based on a John Howe painting. John did this great painting of Shelob with her legs all scrunched up, sort of half out of the hole. And, you know, Pete really loved that image. It's something as an arachnophobe you've seen lots of times in books of spiders laying in wait with just sort of the tips of their legs sort of poking out of this hole that you'd think would be too small for them to actually crawl out of, but it isn't.
That previous shot when he's hanging over him, man, that's the one. Every time I've seen this with an audience, they scream out.
This is another great moment where Pete uses silence.
It's all about, you know, creating contrast and having the scariest moments really are the ones that come out of complete nothingness. And again, it's it allows us to be fairly subtle with the sound itself, but still have it be impactful because of the fact that it does come out of silence.
Shelob was like what we attempted in Moria. Like once you enter Moria, you were in your own unique world. And all of the singing in Moria was all in Dwarvish, and it was all sung by men. Like, you'd never really heard this sound anywhere in Fellowship of the Ring, except when you got to Moria. And then it progressed all through Moria. It took you on this journey through the world of Moria, and then took you outside. And Shelob had its own sound, its own characteristic, its own composition specifically for this world, its own orchestration, its own way of playing it, you know, and that was the attempt of doing that.
A very complicated piece of animation choreography here, Chris Atala animated.
And Chris George did all the
webbing, yeah.
I think you could sort of scour the world and find 50 great animators, but you can't. You know, you sort of get your good core, and then
We had a team of, you know, over 40, and they were, you know, they turned into the best team in the world, at least by the Academy's standards. You know,
yep.
By the end of it, they could, you know, most of them could animate anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had about 14 people on Shelob, who also, you know, some of whom worked on, you know, Gollum. You want to get the essence of what spiders do and how they operate, but also, you know, need to take it into that much more operatic realm of the fantastic, because something like this is, you know, where he's pushing him up the wall and he can't quite get at Sam, you know, is something you wouldn't see any spider worth his salt doing, but it's
well, Shelob 2 was a sequence that was really hard to sort of figure out and start, but that finished really quickly and very easily. Once we sort of got through the design phase and the general motions and the animations,
very quickly,
amazingly fast. Yeah.
Nailed down. Yeah, I mean, one thing, the arena in which she works fighting, you know, Sam, is just about big enough for her to sit in.
Yeah.
And it was all shot with wide angle lenses, so it was very tricky because she occupies so much space in there that it's very hard for her not to get close to the camera in an ugly way. She's positioned to camera in a way that's quite false, but feels right.
What I love about the whole resolve of the Shelob scene is that even though she's, you know, this disgustingly evil creature, she actually isn't an emissary or she isn't one of Sauron's minions. She does, this is just where she lives, and Gollum's clever enough to use her as you know, use her to try and kill Frodo. But, you know, she doesn't have any agenda with getting the ring or helping Sauron get the ring. She's just there and that's where she lives and this is her lair. And so the fact that, you know, she isn't willing to risk her life for a meal, and so, you know, Sam puts up enough of a fight that she just creeps off back into the darkness.
But you talk about being able to get actors and after casting find out there's all these wonderful surprises, like them being able to sing and whatnot, being able to take advantage of the fact that Elijah Wood can, like, stare for minutes on end without blinking, and to be able to take advantage of that for a scene like this.
Yeah, you should have seen, you remember the dailies, you'd look at him and you'd just think, I can't believe he's not blinking. I can't
remember people talking about getting a t-shirt that says, Frodo never blinks.
And she has her way with them. That's how she likes to be.
The original, there was a concert where we'd actually cut out of the scene before these guys came down, one of the earlier cuts. We actually ended on him sobbing away with Holdus holding Frodo. And we cut away back to Minas Tirith, I think. And then we came back, so, but it was actually, I think, the scene worked far better, continuing the action and having the orcs turn up. It was a far better way of getting out of the scene once they'd cut Frodo away.
This is a great use of scale doubles coming up. Billy is sort of laying on the ground just below the frame line, and what happens is one of our scale doubles is actually the one being tossed out the door by John Noble, and they choreographed it in such a way that he, you know, the scale double rolled forward, and then Billy sort of finishes the last maybe eighth of the roll and stands up. But it's completely seamless, but you've really got two actors sort of, you know, completing one move. You'd never know it.
And then what the color graders did is they darkened a bit over the face of our scale double so that you wouldn't pick up his face. It wouldn't read when he does his first rotation towards camera. And that way it's nice and neat.
Pour oil on the wood! I love it when he closes the door and he says, pour oil on the wood. And in one of the takes, he slams the door shut and he says, pour wood on the oil.
Oh, that's right.
Always like that one better. Oh, this miniature shot is just so tremendous.
We had a lot of fun designing that because we had to work out which buildings were going to be hit by the flaming balls of hay and shoot them both intact and also shattered so that at the moment that the flames hit the building, that the digital would then animate the breaking of the buildings. So each of those buildings that gets hit had to be shot both intact and damaged.
It was a shot that came on nice again. It was a very quick, last-minute move by Alex on a mini, turned over to us, add battle, you know, wide shot of battle.
These shots are great because they sort, you know, it's a way to use effects without drawing attention to anything. I mean, there's these trolls just causing damage, but never once are they really the focus of, you know, of the shot. Does the shot say, oh, look, we've got a troll in the shot? They're just there as matter of fact as the orcs are or the Gondorians.
Yeah, throwaway troll.
Yeah, that was an optional troll. We didn't have to do that if we didn't want to. Per Peter.
Well, that's one of the things. It's nice to have these characters tucked into the backs of shots just to
get
it more
crazy. Yeah. Fantastic, yeah.
And here we go. This shot was something that we had in a in our trailer when he actually lands, but of course you didn't get this in the theatrical cut, so it's great to finally see this sequence.
This was in the theatrical cut for a long, long time. It came out relatively late, and I think it was predominantly a momentum issue because you wanted to get to the Rohan cavalry moment, you know, and not shortchange this. And also it had to do with the way the Witch King was going to be dispelled and not sort of taking away from the Eowyn confrontation that's going to come later.
You know, a lot of the folks worked real hard on this to make it look good, and then it's good they'll be able to see it in the DVD.
The world of men will
mourn. We had intended on doing a full sort of a workup on the Witch King voice, but it arrived so late in the piece we weren't able to do much to it. We had to rely upon the performance.
Witch King is one of those ones that quite a few different voices were tried out.
And I think Andy Serkis in the end was the voice we actually used for him.
Yeah.
This was always wonderful, this shot. Yeah, sort of our sort of Apache shot.
Yeah,
like
so
the western,
beautiful.
The big western shot with all the Indians are right up on top of the hill.
Of course, it's a composite shot with about four or five different layers of horses spreading out across there.
Yeah, it was all shot on location, too, yeah. all those different layers.
Yeah.
So here comes the big battle. So they had a group of horses, probably about 100 horses up there, and we had to, you know, again, make it seem like 6,000 of them. So a lot of horse duplications, pike, you know, duplicating pikes in the background to make it look like like the army extends beyond the one row in the front.
It was a very cool scene to witness shooting. Peter went down there to shoot Bernard, and he delivered such a great speech, and on horseback. I mean, you know, he was just such a natural at it. It was pretty inspiring. I had my folks there that day, and my dad actually was holding a spear behind the front column, and he was very excited by the fact that he was playing a...
Was he in costume?
No, he was just holding a spear behind a horse.
Because I remember security had some, you know, they were kicking some guy out.
No, but I just remember thinking that, you know, he was a bit thinking twice about, like, you know, was this such a good idea? You know, was a horse going to step back and crush him? But he was very proud of the fact that he was holding a spear in the background.
Bernard wanted a way to rally his troopers and identify with them, and so he came up with the idea of riding down the line and touching swords with their spears to rally them to the charge.
This is an interesting little moment that Peter picked out early on as wanting to have sort of a special sound for Theoden riding down the ranks, hitting his sword on all these spears. And so Brent spent a bit of time like getting just the right sound for that. And then we ended up, Brent cut it literally to what the picture is doing, and then when Peter heard it back on the final stage, he was like, well, I know that's probably what it's doing literally, but it feels like it needs to be faster. So we doubled it up to make it faster, and of course it works fine with the picture because it's happening so fast.
Oh yeah, in sound design I remember going through many versions of many different horns. For almost every time you see a horn in any of the films in the trilogy, we went through a lot of research and played Peter lots of different variations.
The horns that we ended up with were pitched to work with the music that Howard scored.
Right. There's dignity and honor and bravery in that piece. So I used the Hardanger as the call to it. A Norwegian fiddle that has sympathetic strings. It has a very specific sort of Nordic sound to it. And that became a sort of a dominant kind of sound as part of the Rohan music.
All of this Pelennor Field stuff is shot, predominantly shot at Twizel, at the sheep station. And it was a huge, carefully planned battle that we filmed that took lots of work, lots of preparation.
Jeff Murphy in the second unit shot a lot of this charge, and what was really amazing about it was just, you know, we were able to get about 300 horses, and just the number of charges we'd be doing down this hill and then on the flat land in front of the tracking vehicle. During the major clashes and whatnot, the stunt department really worked well with Jeff and the horse riders, and also the New Zealand Army that came in as extras for the orcs, and were able to create a lot of setups that actually looked quite dangerous with a lot of stuff happening, but was actually quite safe. They'd be stacking up to camera. Everything would look like it's a tightly packed group of people, but in fact there's safe lanes for horses to easily go through and people not to get trampled, with stunt coordinators and stuntmen and whatnot on the ends in costume, doing tumbles and stuff, making it look like they were connecting to the weapons of the horses.
This scene always makes me think about how awful it is for actors, with all this oil poured over in their eyes, going up their nostrils.
I've always liked this camera move around him and him looking up under his brow.
This sequence here...
There's a ratings issue.
Whenever you have people burning... you know, the amount of screen time that you can commit to people on fire, it's a definite ratings issue for PG-13.
So we actually, that sequence had originally gone longer.
Yeah, and it got trimmed back for ratings issues.
Is a dummy that Weta Workshop did a fantastic job as a silicon David Wenham Faramir face in costume, and it's the creepiest thing because it's so lifelike. They've still got it lying around at Weta Workshop, and you go there and you swear it's the actor just lying down having a sleep.
There was some discussion about whether Shadowfax, when the moment comes, would actually kick Denethor onto the burning pyre or not, like whether that would be within Shadowfax's character.
Coming up, the shot of Denethor actually falling back into the fire actually involves a classic, very simple in-camera effect, what we call a beam splitter, where we actually put like a piece of glass in front of the camera we can shoot through, but it also reflects off to the side a flame bar that's against black, so you can actually superimpose within the camera just all live without having to back up the film or anything and see what's actually happening, having additional flames. And Jeff Murphy, who's very gifted at using a lot of these old tricks and whatnot, set it up and saved us a lot of time, and it turned out looking great.
This is always very funny. When you see Denethor in a bundle of flames, having run a huge distance and to do his leap off the end of the prayer.
And run past an entirely good fountain, which could have put it out.
Yes. Should have had a shot. I should have asked for a pickup shot there. Yeah. Of him leaping into the pool and floundering around.
We did build up this amazing library that we could say, oh, we need a guy running on fire. And they could, you know, grab the appropriate flame and smoke elements and relatively quickly comp it in.
The horns that the guys on the Mummical use, again, had to be like a very special sort of a distinctive sound.
The Mummakill, entering the battle, in force.
There was extensive discussion and eventually some very comprehensive previs that was done for the scene. Rather than plan out the battle, it was a very free-form discussion. Pete just wanted this high-adrenaline, chaotic action sequence with these elephants. The way we approached the previs, we basically designed what we call vignettes, which are little action pieces of the Mummakill versus the Rohirrim. And we did this all in 3D computer graphics, and then Pete would ask for camera angles and just coverage as you would with a shooting unit. You just get a lot of cameras and you cover different pieces of the action, and then he'd take all that footage and he'd edit it together and then hand back a sequence to Weta Digital.
So on these Mummakill shots, yeah, we got the previs, and then the next challenge in all this was getting as many live action guys in the foreground as possible, but with a moving camera to try and mimic the previs guys would sort of give us diagrams saying the car is going approximately 30k an hour, you know, we need 10 horses sort of around the camera as we're chasing them, we need to sort of tilt up to see a Mummakill within a second and then tilt back down.
And it was an interesting challenge to shoot the live action elements that are integrated into the sequence, because often we had this previs but not a very detailed version of where things were going to happen or how they were going to happen, so we had to shoot a lot of generic action that we know would be able to be cut in or composited into the ultimate sequence you see on screen.
We'd go back, shoot our live action stuff we shot for like 7 or 8 weeks, then those would come back, the green screen live-action horse plates would come back, camera tracks would have to be made from that, and then we'd have to go back and redo the animation based on those camera tracks. We sort of did it twice for every one of those shots.
This shot we worked on all year and then redid it in 2 days on the day it was due.
We went in and showed it to Peter and said, here's the shot. And he goes, it's not quite how I remembered it. It was a little more dynamic at one point.
Right, the thing was, it was all about the guy who was being pulled over by his dead rider.
That's right.
And and we started out at the beginning of that shot because of what the live action dictated for us to do. So we had to throw out all the live action and do all the foreground crosses and everything digitally.
Yeah. Well, we have some live action. But anyway, we redid the whole shot in 2 days, to make a long story short.
And that's how that shot ended up, and it was refined right down to the wire.
This battle is huge, and it's one of those things where I can't speak quickly enough to do justice to any of these shots. It was a very difficult piece of animation, one of the most difficult that's ever been done, I think, you know. It was a real challenge to get a sense of, you know, variation in these beasts and also a sense of weight, and then at the same time, you know, all this massive stuff. I mean, there are many, many pieces of very bold, daring choreography throughout this sequence that you know, are just defying the laws of natural motion and yet trying to look real nevertheless.
Our camera department was kept pretty busy by this show. Most of the time, we wanted the camera to have a certain amount of momentum.
For an action picture like this, Pete knows that, you know, you've got to keep it moving.
You know, the camera is you, the viewer, getting to see the action, and there was always so much happening and so much to see that it always felt better if you were moving along with the action.
And also, you know, keeping these shots moving keeps it real when there are these fake characters in it.
So this was all added in because it gives you a bit more character stuff of... shows that Eowyn is a pretty good warrior. This was a nice little moment too, a nice little respite in all the battle action. It was nice to have this little sequence here where it looks like all was lost, and have this little nice little moment here between Gandalf and Pippin.
I didn't think it would end this way.
On film three, there was about 2 million feet of film shot. In order to handle that sort of stuff, you've got to have some really, really good working processes. And Peter's were very good. He would get me to assemble the rushes in shooting order. Not script order, shooting order. The first shot would come up, and he'd go, "Ah, yes, I remember. Go straight to the third take, that's the one. We did a couple afterwards, but they weren't nearly as good, and he went off the boil." And the next shot would, you know, the next angle would come up. "Oh, yes, yeah. Now just go to the last couple of takes on this, because we reframe because of such and such." That was 3 years ago. Now, all he needed to jog his memory was that they were in shooting order. Because then he, I don't know how he did it, he just... rewound the tape in his head back to the beginning of the shoot for that day, and he ran it from that point. The man is bloody formidable, I tell you. You work in a room where, I mean, I'd worked with the material longer than he had, and stuff that I was forgetting, and this man would come in and do that, and you'd go, "Gotta watch my P's and Q's here."
I think our sound department does a great job in here because, you know, the effects work was amazing. But, you know, in the end, I mean, some of these things that are happening weren't physically there. And it's sound always kind of gives that, you know, that final element to make sure that there's weight given to all this. And just sort of the sheer weight of that horse being thrown and hitting the ground, you know, sound did a great job with the effects on that.
You know, some of these scenes like this one, we may have gotten to a point where it's tough to go much further until the visuals get a little more developed, and Peter didn't have a lot of sympathy for us. He was his response was, "Well, you know, when I cut the scene, I had to imagine what it was going to look like, so you know, that's what you guys should be doing." So we took that to heart, and you know, just started going for it,
trying to sort of mentally imagine how wide the arc was that this mace was swinging, when we thought that the mace was going to be hitting the ground. We had a vague idea of what the mace was going to look like, but, you know, very roughly.
So, details.
So
it's all part of the process. Good to develop the imagination.
Yeah, it was basically Peter's response was, you know, look, if you can't see it, just imagine it.
And then, here come the pirate ships, shot with the camera moving very, very fast to get a little bit of flapping in the sails. Several pirate ships all stacked up. Here's some tile sets that we shot just for backgrounds of all this action. This guy's called George, also known as the orc with the funny hat. There's our miniature ship again. This is interesting because, of course, there really wasn't a ship as such in full size. So even when you see Aragorn in close-up jumping off, that is this 24th scale ship in extreme close-up. And it's amazing how well it stands up. It's a tribute to the art of the guys who built these Corsair ships, that all the ropes and all of the canvas and stuff, just it looks like they had the ship built full-size.
The whole army of the dead. Mostly massive based on motion capture.
And we had to shoot them in separate layers so that you could see through from one to the next.
Pete was describing how he wanted this effect to appear of the Witch King. He always was using the analogy of when they take those styrofoam cups down to deep sea pressures and they bring them back up and they've all been smushed up.
To give him a little bit more special performance, we talked Peter into actually having digital Witch King that gets destroyed and sort of implodes. And Jason Schleifer actually did the animation on that.
Witch King folding. It's the old tin can being crushed.
Tried to really make it look like whatever force was keeping him alive was just giving away and he was just collapsing.
16. I remember when we were mixing, Peter was really keen to get that competition between Gimli and Legolas in counting bodies again, and it was very tricky to fit those numbers in there above the sound of the music and the effects, and somehow Michael Somatic managed to do it.
The intercut here between Eowyn and Gothmog and the Army of the Dead and all the sort of intercutting here was, that was really difficult to make work.
We tried lots of different ways here, didn't we? We wanted to get the whole integration of all these things happening at the same time, but you couldn't have Aragorn arriving too late or too early because, the whole... concept of rescuing Eowyn or being there at the right time.
So this scene here, Pete was looking at the Mimak shots and he goes, okay, now about Legolas, well, you know, we need something cool for him to do.
Yeah, so Christian came out of a previous discussion one day and said, well, Peter wants to have Legolas take down a Mimak hill single-handedly. We thought, well, how are you going to do that? So he described the action that they were talking about having him leap on the Mimak hill, climb up some of the arrows that were embedded in the skin, have a fight with some of the Harad on the top of the Mimak hill, cut the basket off, and then be able to take the Mimak hill down from there.
And actually to accomplish this, he actually was on top of a pile of sandbags and fighting these stunt guys, and the sandbags were replaced by this Mimak hill.
And what we were able to do was to take that movement and attach it to the movement of a Mimak hill going through the proper motion. We had a lot of freedom of movement.
It's just such a cool thing to just sort of think up on the fly like that.
Yeah, we're actually pretty sure that Ollie wants to play James Bond at some point.
That seemed kind of cheesy. I mean, people just love it in the theatre.
One of the favourite sequences,
yeah.
Isn't it?
In this whole sequence, we'd seen the Army of the Dead sort of rolling through, you know, the orcs, but we'd never actually seen them take down a Mimak hill. And we didn't want to have them take down a Mimak hill before Legolas did, so we saved the Army of the Dead taking down the Mimak hill until the battle was pretty much over and they had reached Minas Tirith.
Something as subtle as, you know, having the sound of the swarming ghosts over the cities, just letting that carry out a little longer, continue a little longer, really sort of helps resolve the moment into this next scene. So it's one of the nice ways that we can, you know, extend the drama through the sound.
And this is a scene that Fren asked to go back in and reshoot.
Yes, it was.
Performance.
Yeah, the original. Yeah. I actually thought the original shoot wasn't bad. It was a bit tearful, a lot more tearful. Yeah. A different sort of performance.
Yeah.
But this actually ended up being nice. There were some lovely moments in the stuff of the reshoot.
Yeah. I thought their friends' calls on things like this, you know, doing a whole pickup shoot of this entire scene, and they were brave calls, but I think that they were good calls.
Mm-hmm.
And they really worked for the film.
It's great because, you know, this actual scene is just done on a small little stage, just a little insert stage, basically. And, You've got Bernard Hill lying on just some ground that's basically maybe 5 feet by 6 feet in size, and all those reverses on Miranda Otto actually are blue screen with Weta just throwing in the sky. So you can have a real intimate little shoot there on a stage, keep everything nice and quiet, and give the actors what they need to go there. And then yet it feels like it's actually out there at the location.
Peter wanted a kind of visual exclamation point to say, the battle's over, all's well. So at the very, very end, we decided to shoot another whole shot. The God beams coming down, hitting Minas Tirith, revealing the fact that the battlefield is calm, that everything's kind of warm, and things are good again. And, of course, we had to do some hot interactive patches where the God beams, which are digitally done, where they would hit the city. And since Peter never uses a static camera, we moved the camera. It's like a little rock in the foreground because, of course, moving the camera at that distance would hardly see anything happening down at the city of Minas Tirith. So you put something in the foreground to show that actually you're helicoptering along past, let's say, the spur of rock where the beacon is or something, just to show you that you really are moving the camera.
This is actually really clever because not only is it funny, what Gimli says.
Bad idea. Very handy in a tight spot, these lads, despite the fact they're dead.
Gimli's lines also kind of help fulfill that plot point device of, if these guys are so amazing and really took over and saved the day, why don't we hold on to them for when we're surrounded, you know, at the Black Gates, you know, with dealing with like 50-1 odds. That's another really good reason for having that line in there. So it serves dual purposes there, and it's a clever bit of screenwriting.
Yes.
Why are you seeing them off now for? We need to keep them. Help us later down the track.
This extra sequence was quite important to put back in. I felt basically for it shows Pippin finding his first look at trying to find Mary, and also shows Emma discovering Eowyn. So it was actually useful to have it, and it's a little bit of background story that was good to have. So this little sequence of going from here and in through into the Houses of Healing was an important background sequence for those characters.
Putting this in required us to put in about another 15 minutes of footage, I think, which we'll get to soon.
Yeah, people thought that Eowyn was dead, and that she was dead and being cradled by her brother Éomer, which necessitated, you know, Houses of the Healing and a whole bunch of other things when we were really trying to wrestle with pace and momentum issues coming down the last, you know, sort of hour of the film.
Aragorn, as the king-to-be of Gondor, is attempting to revive Eowyn, to bring her back from her illness. And you hear Arwen's voice, and it's such a great moment, and it's such a great idea, because it connects the two women. It connects Arwen and Eowyn by their love for Aragorn. And by seeing Aragorn and Eowyn, and he places his hand on the side of her face, and only a king can heal, and he's showing the moment that he is becoming king, and also by coming king, he is taking Arwen as his queen. It's a really beautiful piece that was created for that scene. And so having the Arwen song, which we really wanted to use in the film, Fran suggested it in Houses of Healing. We wrote a piece called Twilight and Shadow, and that's sung by Renee Fleming, and that's what you actually hear.
We decided to actually make it more of a montage to set up not only the healing of Eowyn, but to start to get the connection going between Eowyn and Faramir. This is going to be back to night shot. It was a day scene for the theatrical, and we've gone back to night because obviously we've done the process, gone through a night. Eowyn was healed during the night, probably night morning really.
Seems like a bit of a time cut. They've been like having hours healing, and she's recovered, and this poor is still out on the battlefield looking for his buddy. You know, it's like, where'd everybody go?
Yeah, they seem to have conveniently forgotten the sort of, you know.
Hey, go send some sandwiches out to Pippin. He's still out there.
They seem to have forgotten the kind of the third member of the fellowship.
Yeah.
Oh, you're the merry guy? Yeah, is he out there somewhere? Ah, yeah.
Oh, she's cute. Save her. Come on, let's go.
But it's always great to go and just see how everything was coming together on Minis, because they're such amazing models. This shot, flying into the Kirathungal Tower, is pretty tricky. Going from such a far distance in through such a small window and right into a live-action shot, those shots are always a little bit difficult to conceive because it's not the kind of thing you could ever do in real life.
This scene, though, I love because...
this was great.
I thought about this moment from my childhood where I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't figure out where I was and where the sound of this drunken, you know, music was coming from. And it sort of flashed on that when we came to this scene. And so the brief was basically, well, let's, like, have the orcs down below be doing this drunken party. You know, when he wakes up, it sort of will add to his disoriented state of mind.
Keep your eye on the orc, because his wig comes flying off, and he's actually that one there.
Yeah, it's so quick though.
It's quick.
That's one for the frame by framers.
But yeah, we basically gathered up as many people as we could, and went into one of the smaller mixing stages, and we had sort of mixed crew and editorial crew. We had some of the behind-the-scenes crew as well were there, and we just did this manic, drunken orc recording session. It was great. It was like it was a starring moment for the sound team.
I just love the idea that the orcs are actually have like their own, you know, even though they're these sort of horrible, despicable creatures, they do like to party and have fun and actually play music.
Mm.
You know, although it's like sloppy, drunken music.
Standard procedure on the Minis is to shoot as many different passes as possible. You oftentimes don't know when you get to do the shot what kinds of elements you're going to need. A good percentage of them don't get used, but it's always the one that you don't shoot is the one that you need.
In the script, and actually what we shot as well, there's a moment as Sam's walking through the main gate there. You have these characters that we see, these two horrific-looking statues on either side of the doorway, and they were called the Watchers.
Yeah, that what we used to jokingly refer to as the evil turnstile. He gets that little walkway and can't quite get through. He has to sort of use Sting to kind of push his way through, as if he's moving a subway kind of turnstile.
You know, in the end, it was something that Pete chose not to include in the cut.
I think what's great about the DVD commentary is if real fans object to the fact that things are missing, you can always mention, oh yeah, we shot it. Trust us, we shot it, and for reasons of pacing or time, you know, we just could not fit it in.
And that sound again, that mix of Sean making those noises, that was something that we came up with in the mix. Peter said, wouldn't it be great to go with the shadow to have the sense of this big presence coming up the stairs?
In the process of extending the DVD cut, we obviously need to ensure that the vest was taken by an orc, because that turns up later in the Black Gate sequence.
There's a lot of inconsistencies in Tolkien's original text, and sort of the fact that we've used in this cinematic version that when the ring gets put on, Sauron is aware of its use, and he's aware of its presence at that very time. And so to have Sam wear the ring right on the gates of Mordor and not have it evoke some kind of awareness within Sauron would be an inconsistency in the world. Also, to have him wear it sort of belittles its power, and even though we've built up the hobbits are very resilient to its evil, and Sam probably the most resilient out of all of them, to even to have someone else wear it at this point in the film where we've built up what it does to be a ring bearer, it would have been too great an inconsistency.
It's too late. It's over.
And this is, in fact, one of these moments where the ring comes into play, and we again get the sense of how persuasive the ring can be. Basically, Sam's only been carrying it for what is, you know, probably a comparatively short time. But already it's making a play for him.
I
This scene is actually a cousin to the scene where Frodo sends Sam away, in that it was originally shot with a certain dramatic intention, which was simply for Frodo to have this kind of crazed reaction to the fact that here's the ring and Sam's got it. And if you watch carefully right here, you know, little gestures that weren't actually shot with this intention make it appear that Sam is somewhat coveting the ring, maybe even being tempted by it. That shot was originally about Sam being scared by what he's seen Frodo go through, but because you don't have the reverse angle there, you know, Fran and Peter were able to make it look like Sam was having a ring obsession moment, when actually that was not what was the intention. And that sort of lateral thinking is obviously the mark of great filmmaking, but Peter and Fran excel at, particularly because you were taking material that was definitely not intended for the purpose and make it seem like something it wasn't, but it works.
It will destroy you, Sam.
Sam and Frodo seeing Mordor for the first time got worked on for most of the show. It just kept sort of moving along, trying to figure out what the look of Mordor was going to be, and sort of constantly evolving. And it got to the point where a few days before it was delivered, we just sort of started again with it, because we had developed so many other scenes of Mordor that were so different from what we were doing with it earlier, that we just kind of did it again, just basically started and came up with a look that was more consistent with the rest of the show.
The eye has a sound, which it's one of those things that sort of started developing on the first film, and it's one of those things that sort of was sound designed in the on the final mix stage, when Peter and Fran could be there to give feedback directly on it. And since that point, we've sort of just kept developing on that basic signature sound, which one element to it is the Alan Howard vocal element, which we've sort of established as a Sauron sound.
Just make it down the hill.
You and I had done 3 full cuts by the time that we had Peter come into the room. Mm. And so there was every chance that we'd be hanging on to, you know, in our heads and being bolshy about changing things that we'd done. But in fact, the project was far too big to stick your own oar in.
Yeah, I think
on things
I think,
like that.
Yeah,
it was far too important.
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, what we did was lots of little moments that I think we achieved in the process when we were cutting, before Peter came in the cutting room. I think we actually, a lot of those were saved. They are in the cut. Yeah.
I don't think I made this point before. We never did what was typical, which is to preview the movie, get an audience reaction, and use that as a guide to cutting the film, increasing the pace, clarifying issues. Instead, we relied really upon ourselves, and also upon input from the studio, he needs time and safe passage, so that any questions of clarity, which you'd usually need to get from an outside source, because when you're making a movie, you become so enmeshed in the story, you become so familiar with the story, that things that may not be that may be clear to you aren't necessarily clear to an audience. And you need fresh eyes or outside eyes to actually point that out to you. And in our case, it was really New Line, particularly not so much Mark, because Mark was there most of the time with us, but really Bob and Michael and other people at New Line.
Certainty of death, small chance of success. What are we waiting for?
The scene in the Great Hall was truncated because ending it, I think, on Gimli saying, "What are we waiting for?" and then seeing them ride out is a great way to move the story forward. This is, however, a wonderful scene because it shows you more dimension to Aragorn's character, and it shows you that he's using a thought as a way to ensnare Sauron.
This is obviously a new scene, similar to the Palantir scene in the beginning of the opening of the movie. Obviously different because you know, it's doing a different thing.
We actually played Sauron talking directly to Aragorn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do we have black speech for "you're a worthless sack of shit"? It'll never amount to anything. You know? Who's ugly and his mother dresses him funny.
Peter's one of those guys that you always have to do it in a slow process. I mean, he likes to see it all there first.
He's an extraordinarily methodical man in the cutting room. Sometimes you picked an order which was
quite out of the blue.
And also, I think sometimes too, we picked a different order to what I might have done originally.
Yes.
Which was a bit of a worry.
Peter's, as he's editing the film, I'm composing it, I'm writing it, and I'm working with him as he's editing it. And he would edit in threads of the movie. Aragorn, Gimli, Legolas. Thread, journey, you know, and he would edit quite a lot of that. By doing that, you were writing those scenes very linearly, but then he would intercut the scenes. This is a very important thing to understand. So once they're intercut, scenes actually play differently because of what's coming before them and after them. And the thread of the story is kind of shaping and unfolding as Peter does the intercutting. And actually, once he does it, and then he's reshaping the intercutting. So it's all, you know, so it's changing to a degree. You may write it and think it's a certain way, but then you realize once the intercut is done, you realize the positioning of it in the film, that it actually has a much more central part to the film. Here was a sound in this particular scene that's a little more evolved. And the piece is a new piece in the sense that their relationship is new.
The look of the eye and the fact that it's ever watchful and it's looking out over the armies was a very difficult nut to crack, as far as it not looking like a lighthouse or a big beacon. And part of the problem was solved by the animation of it giving this erratic, nervous sort of look. Pete wanted to play it that the armies, that Sauron's kind of, he's not completely naive. He is aware that, you know, that something's not quite right. You know, the ring hasn't sort of been seen for a while. He doesn't really know where it is. He thinks he's got the upper hand, but he's just in the back of his mind, you know, there's something going on. And so he is actually still scanning his lands for what possibly could be his downfall, which again gives more impact to Aragorn's decision to ride out to meet him at the Black Gates, because then it completely justifies Sauron sending his armies out to the gate and freeing up the journey for Frodo and Sam to get to Mount Doom.
Oh, this was shot up at an active volcano on the North Island, Mount Rupehu.
This little road area was just an area that took you from the lower, what they call Happy Valley, where the beginner skier area from Mount Whakapapa was, to the main area where you could take a chairlift up to the tougher runs. So we just actually shot along the side of the ski field for these sequences. And when we actually see the hobbits escape from the marching orcs soon in these next few shots, actually there are a lot of these little ski chalets that were just in the background, so Weta didn't just have to kind of put in, you know, cool, you know, dark skies. They also had to make sure they removed the ski chalets that were behind the little tent cities that we created.
You used the ski lifts to go down to our catering area, which was in kind of a base station on the ski slope.
Sam, help me.
This is all added back in as well.
Yeah, this whole sequence was actually a real Peter favorite. And I'm sure he's thrilled that he put it back in, because it was one of those moments of great kind of humor, but also cleverness on behalf of Frodo and Sam.
The whole process was meant to be that the ring was getting heavy. That was causing a lot around Frodo's neck, and that was sapping a lot of energy from him. And they had to somehow get a distraction, obviously, to get away. But it just didn't seem to quite.
To quite gel
the scene. It wasn't enough. You felt like they needed to be confrontated a bit more with the orcs. So actually they had to run, or they had to kind of get away, escape from the orcs with them chasing them or something.
But again, at this point in the theatrical version, when you're really, you know, sort of racing toward the final confrontation at the Black Gates, the feeling was that, you know, in the theatrical version you wanted to keep the momentum chugging along and not sort of take this tangent. But you got to love this guy with no nose.
It works, a little scene. It just still took a while to work to get the scene to work.
Really good thing about it are the wonderful prosthetics, really. All the orc faces.
Yes. And we got to use this shot, which was had been a yes. completed shot that had been delivered quite early in the piece, so we managed to get that back in.
We had a miniature of Mount Doom, and we did shoot it several different heights and several different angles. It was basically used as a matte painting element. It didn't really get a lot of play in terms of being actually used as a live shot.
Oh, we're going to be walking up the mountain for about 3 years.
We have a sequence coming up where, in fact, Frodo and Sam decide that they just have to shed all of this armor, that they can't actually sort of carry on it up the hill. And the Foley team, Red Lion in Australia, were very keen to do this particular move because it was very symbolic for them, because for three movies they had carried around Sam's pack, this prop, Sam's pack, which is this very sort of a distinctive sound because of these pans, rattling pots and pans attached to it. And they were so looking forward to the ceremonial dumping of Sam's pack in this little scene. And so when the scene was actually dropped from the cut, they were gutted. They were absolutely gutted. So they're extremely happy to know that this little sequence is now back in, and they finally can dispose of Sam's pack. Here it goes. Yes, and it's down. They're a cleansing moment for them, I think.
This is another great location. This was actually in the plains just below Mount Ruapehu in the middle of the North Island of New Zealand. And just a really cool place with all these boulders there.
For the Mount Doom cloud, we shot some tank clouds, but they were used as part of our pyroclastic system for doing the cloud. So we would take small elements of the tank clouds and find pieces of the animation that had the appropriate dynamics and have our system that would actually create the smoke effect then basically drive those elements as textures.
Here's our big landscape with the eye swishing back and forth. But we did the moving eye light using a beam steerer, a mirror, to steer the beam so that we would actually have the interactive light going to the various parts of the landscape. This is a really nice reveal. The Black Gates are at 24th scale, so it's pretty small to shoot anything close up. So to do that reveal from coming up behind the rock, of course, we did the foreground rock at a larger scale so we could hold the focus on it.
There's a few drops left.
This scene here was shot again in the pickup shoot, but went back to the original shoot at the end of the day. I think this was stronger. I like this original shoot better.
There's some sort of quality about that original footage, and I'm never sure whether it's because it's the performance you first saw, and which sort of took your emotion with it, or whether it is actually a bit of it. Sometimes there's just something special about that first shoot of something.
It doesn't quite get recreated in the pickup, does it?
No.
And this sequence of Black Gates was shot not very far away from, about a quarter of the way around Mount Ruapehu. Mount Ruapehu, the name of the volcano is a Maori word, and in Maori, WH is pronounced as an F, so the name of the mountain is called Whakapapa.
Now, this shot actually was done on the opposite side of Mount Ruapehu, at the Tikino ski field area, which is actually opposite from Whakapapa ski field.
The pulse that we've associated with the ring, the heartbeat of it, has turned into really migraine pulse. It's just oppressive beat that's just throbbing in his head. So basically the soundtrack goes into his head at that point, and it's just, throbbing. Peter's idea about this was that the Sauron light beam has got Frodo pinned to the ground and is like, keeping him there.
Where are they?
Here we finally come to the Black Gates. We had shot the Black Gates, of course, very extensively for film 2, and then they came back again with a vengeance for film 3, because it's a major sequence, a lot of action, a lot of establishing shots, and then a lot of just background material for at various points for dialogue shots and whatnot. We had a sort of standard layout that Alan had worked out, which established where the mound, which was the little slightly raised area where the Gondorian troops had been drawn up, and what that apparent distance was to the gates, and then everything was anchored to that, to the relationship between the mound and the gates. So no matter which shot we were doing, we'd work out what the correct geometry would be. This is a very, very convincing miniature. It's supposed to be, of course, huge sheets of iron all riveted together. It's all done with lead. So it really has a tremendous texture, really rich, rusty, cruel kind of texture. That's a quarter scale set. That's, I think, the one time that the quarter scale was used. And then cut back to our small scale miniature.
The Mouth of Sauron.
Yes.
Also known as the Black Lieutenant.
This is an actor we're about to see whose name is Bruce Spence. And again, I made the call to Bruce. He was very understanding that he might have been cut out because he knew that that's the movie business.
But what was really fun about this is when, back before this was cut, there was this desire for the Mouth of Sauron to seem more unmortal. And so what Peter asked Weta to do, if you look closely, is basically increase the Bruce Spence's mouth, you know, like by 200%. So it would be, you know, and we looked at all these wacky, wacky tests, either in making it 200% bigger or maybe just doubling the number of teeth in his mouth.
And we talked about turning the mouth, you know, sideways, so it was vertical up and down and opening sideways, which looks sort of interesting, and to say the least. And then
ultimately, we came up with this idea of just making the mouth bigger, you know, just radically bigger than it could physically be, and putting it sort of back on top of itself.
Thankfully, that's what it became, was just sort of overscaling, picking the area inside the armor and overscaling the mouth up.
Who would have thought? This scene pays off the mithril vest, which you see one of the Uruk-hai make off with, and it's a nice touch. And also a nice taunt, a really great taunt to our friends.
There's something not quite right about this guy, and you can't pin it down.
This guy is kind of like a meat puppet.
Needs to go to a dentist.
And that he's just an actual physical entity that Sauron uses to interact with other physical entities.
I do not believe it.
This whole location where we shot the Black Gates was actually a firing range for the military. And before we showed up, they, you know, took a crew through and made sure there was no live ammunition on the ground. But we got a very severe lecture when we first got there, saying, look, if we ever came across anything metal, don't touch it. A lot of the extras came from the local military base. And when you see some of these close-up shots of soldiers reacting to the oncoming enemy, a lot of those guys are just, you know, New Zealand Army personnel, and they did a great job doing some acting out there that day.
We worked out an equitable basis for us to cover their costs and yet not bear the full cost of having hundreds of extras in the middle of really no place, and they treated it as a training exercise, so it was good for them. I think they learned their logistics, and it was a big logistical exercise for them to put that many people out on the field with us.
And oh God, the scene. Covered from here to breakfast time over about 3 days of shooting. Oh man.
It was amazing, eh? I mean, we
sunlight footage, shadow footage.
All different lights. Yes.
You name it. Oh.
It was really funny. We used to look through the dailies. This, we used to crack us up because you see these dailies going through. And it'll be tracking along with these soldiers, and they're obviously all the New Zealand Army guys, and you could hear Rick in the background saying, okay, you're scared now. No, you're moving back. No, you're coming forward. There was all these comments from Rick going on, getting these guys to try and do reactions. It was so funny. Some of the dailies that you just crack up when you hear some of them.
Aragorn does this very rousing speech, which is actually all, in fact, production. He kind of really sort of wound himself up on the day. And so this was in fact one of the few scenes that we actually used a production audio with the odd line cheat in there.
What we've done in these scenes climbing up the mountain is include a lot of steam vents, which is nice because it allows us to have sounds that come and go as opposed to being constant.
which is great, because we don't really want to have the constant sound of steam going, or you know, even the constant sound of wind going, which is why with all our wind tracks we try and include a whole lot of movement and, you know, different wisps and individual little gusts, things that we can pan individually around the room. And so we've done the same thing with steam vents and with grit blows and just individual events that we can spike little moments with. And that allows us to give the feeling that there's heat and steam and wind, but without having these constant beds that just turn into noise. The intercutting that's happening here between this sort of epic scale on the one hand and just this close-up intimate, and it allows us to go from the real wide, the wide distant sound to the close-up breath and be able to hear the details, like, you know, his Frodo's breath just blowing the dust,
you know, his hands, like, you know, basically scratching through the rock.
And I mean, obviously these scenes are driven by the music, which is carrying the emotion.
You want a depth and coherence and emotion and you know, weight to it, and you want to get it right. You feel like Frodo, you know, you're walking up to the end, you know, you're struggling up that hill at the end, you know, you have the ring, and the ring's getting heavier and heavier, you know, and then there's going to be a point when it's going to go over. And that's why you could create the levels of the drama of Sam and Frodo going up Mount Doom and the battle raging in front of the Black Gate. You weren't struggling with it. You had the tools and you had the experience at that point. And so that's how those scenes were created.
And the birds will be nesting in the hazel thicket.
It was really difficult to cut the scene because it was so noisy when they were shooting it. They had all these fans going and stuff, and you could hardly hear the dialogue pop. You could hardly hear Frodo's dialogue. It was really quite difficult to get into the ADR.
Yeah, and it's such an emotional scene, eh?
And to have all that noise around while they're trying to film it, it must have been pretty tough on the actors.
In actual fact, they are actually crawling up the side of an active volcano. It wasn't very active at the time, of course, but only 2 years previously that same volcano had been very active. And they used... where it was shot, there's actually like three volcanic peaks, and one of them is like the classic cone-shaped volcano, and so they actually used that as the base shot for Mount Doom.
Is another interesting thing is you might think that we use the actual volcano peaks in the film, but we had a specific clause in our agreement with the Conservation Department in New Zealand not allowing us to use the photograph, the actual peaks, because it's a sacred Maori land, and they didn't want it photographed. And Peter said, not a problem, Mount Doom is going to be much bigger than any of these volcanoes are. So, of course, the very peaks of the mountains are all replaced by CG.
This, again, for Rodo and paint, became a nightmare because we had to Rodo all those pikes off, because we had to put the black gates back there. They were basically just shot on a field, and so anytime you looked over all these guys and looked off into the distance, we had to Rodo every one of those little pikes and pieces of hair.
Do you know what should be put back in there? Is the Gandalf cutback?
A different tape we used at Gandalf.
Because
now we've got the Mithril vest back in.
Yes.
Gandalf brings the Mithril vest up. And he says for Frodo, we had to take that out because the Mithril vest was, because we took them out of Saranac.
Editing happening right here on the DVD.
It's happening on the DVD, yes.
Yeah.
Look at that, hey? This is another one. This was a lovely moment because we had this moment of Aragorn turning around and looking back at them and then saying for Frodo and charging. Obviously, we had to come up with a way of getting the charge underway.
We were always looking at Elijah and Sean and sort of matching their dirt scar levels and sweat levels, you know. And so we used that as a guide throughout the shots to know where we needed to take Gollum, along with the fact that Gollum got beaten up a bit more.
Towards the end of production, Peter was piling on more shots and more sound effects and more of everything. And I think we had something like 400 shots to deliver in the last few weeks of production, to the point where we actually had to go to New Line and work out a revised delivery schedule that allowed us to do something very, very unconventional, and that is deliver reels out of order. And the only way we were able to do that was by really the fact that we had digitally color graded the film so that you could have a continuity between reels, even though they were delivered way out of order. They would still match. There would be no bump in the grade between the two. And then on the sound end, we were able to get Euphonics to rewrite their software so that we could preserve the automation even when we rebalanced reels, which again enabled Peter to deliver out of sequence and so in late on some of these reels, staggered.
The idea that every problem there is a solution, you know, but sometimes, you know, the conventional thinking is just not going to get you there. And the idea of coming up with ideas that are so beyond the pale, really the amount of innovation that went on production-wise on the movies, I mean, it's all so easy to say now, but at the time this was completely uncharted terrain that just had to be made to work.
We emailed our entire soundtrack to NT Audio in L.A. to print onto the film, so that was pretty remarkable.
And there'd be a guy, one of our people, Duncan Nemo, who'd be waiting on the other side of the pipe. We called it the Fat Pipe.
My producer and I were on set, and we were just standing around. We, you know, see what we're shooting for the day, and now all of a sudden we see Pippin going, "Look, the Eagles are coming." This is before we even knew that shot was even in the film. "The Eagles are coming." It's like,
oh,
Eagles?
No.
Eagles?
The Eagles are coming!
The Eagles, originally, when we storyboarded the film, didn't show up at this battle. They just showed up to save Frodo and Sam at the end. And their inclusion in the battle was something that happened very late in the piece. It's really great because it adds just another level of dynamic to the battle, having this aerial dogfight over the battle with the fell beasts and the eagles, and it also sets up the fact that they're there to save Frodo and Sam.
We went through a number of different scenarios of how we were going to dress lava. We came back to the realization that the best way to do lava was by doing it as a miniature. We brought over Chuck Schumann, I believe, shot all the lava elements.
We had these guys against green screen, a little bit of billowing smoke and some flashing lights, but as far as what was happening, is lava spouting out of the top, is it pouring down, what's going on, nobody knew. So effectively Chuck shot a whole series of different lighting passes, light from above, light from below, smoky light, clear light, and so forth, just so the compositors would have a chance to put it together any way that they needed. Now that's our first view of the wonderful lava that was shot for this. This is flowing methacel, which is a very thick, gummy substance, lit from below and from above, lit from below with ultraviolet and from above with colored light. And the technique in order to control it is that a huge table with a transparent floor has to be built. This table was 20 feet long and about 12 feet wide. And all of the methacel is laid onto it with it in a horizontal position. The camera's locked to the table. Then when you tilt the table, of course, the camera goes with it. But now gravity is your friend, and gravity now pulls the stuff downhill at whatever speed is defined by the angle of the tilt. So, in effect, you can preset everything, the bits of rock that are floating in the lava, the crust, the dark crust, which is done with a combination of black powder, black dust, and spray paint, all pre-built so that you have it the way you want it to look, and then at the moment when you tilt it, then it all starts to flow. So this is, I think, among the most convincing lava that anybody's ever done. But then, of course, it's all of it's been heavily worked over with digital enhancement. Yeah, flying away.
Entire CG shot.
That's a lot of drama cutting back and forth from one to the other.
It took us a long time to decide actually how to introduce Gollum in this sequence. We couldn't quite decide whether Gollum should come up behind him or should he see the rock hit him and then you see Gollum. So it was actually rather a nice idea that actually Gollum comes up behind him. It's a lot scarier.
The initial impulse was just to take Andy and put him on a motion capture on a guy's back moving around, as it turned out.
Which we did.
Yeah. It didn't work out so well in mocap because he was sort of struggling. We animated that, but we animated Gollum onto Frodo and made sure Frodo was staggering around appropriately. So you didn't just, you know, make it up, you know, you had something to base it off of. I was hoping we'd get more of Frodo's feet in the dust up close, but we didn't get any shots that quite covered that, you know, while Gollum's on his back. But yeah, just a series of very difficult to do shots, each of a different type.
I remember when we first storyboarded the shot, I remember Pete describing it, and I just remember him chuckling. He went, "Oh, I know what we should do. It's pretty audacious. I don't know if we'll get away with it." I said, "What's that?" And he goes, we'll pull out. You'll see Gollum's face, and we'll pull out through the ring." Well, it's actually interesting because Richard Moore did the original previs back in '99, and three or four years later, he actually did the blocking and the animation for the actual shot in the final production.
This is such a great Andy Serkis moment coming up, because it's basically the first time you sort of see Gollum stand straight up without sort of being hunched over and bent. It's a subtle, subtle little thing, but if you look closely, he sort of, you know, sort of actually straightens up. Now that he's got the ring, he's so happy.
A lot of the audience knows he's going to go, you know? He's going to go over. So we wanted to make sure that we'd send them false signals subliminally that he was going to go over, you know, sooner than they expected, you know, with the jumping around, which was part of Peter's choreography, all this dancing around. And killing Gollum, sad moment.
There's a lot of drama that has to play out there. You know, he finally achieves the thing that he's been chasing all this time. And right at the moment that he acquires it and is about to master it again, he realizes that it's betrayed him to his death. And all that has to play out in his face while he's falling down this chasm towards this lava. And even when he hits the lava, it's another one of those dramatic licenses that you have to take, because if you were anywhere near real lava like that, you would burn and it would be obviously very painful. But we needed to allow Gollum the moment of realization and the moment of the lava sort of engulfing him, and to have the pain be more of his realization of the betrayal rather than the physical pain of the lava, because ultimately we figured that wouldn't have been as interesting to people. That's really not what the shot was about.
There was a whole discussion about how long the ring should float, and it actually floats, I mean, you can tell, it floats really until Frodo makes the decision not to give up on life. But there was a lot of debate how long it should float. Should it mean anything that it's floating, and that the ring essentially, even if it can, if Frodo's lost, then maybe in a bizarre way the ring has won.
The idea for this little sequence was that the scream of Sauron Eye actually vibrates down through the body of the tower and really sort of shakes the tower into collapse. And for a minute here, it's almost as if the scream really sucks all the rest of the sound out of the environment. It's really a mixture of organic human animal screams mixed with metallic, groany, straining sounds.
Ah, yes.
Destruction of Barad-dûr.
We started with Alan's original idea of this being one long shot, which is one of the things that motivated us to come up with a digital solution, because it would have been impossible to do that kind of a large helicopter shot as a continuous shot on a miniature.
You could choreograph the particles many different ways, you know. So if you blew up a miniature, there you go, that's it. There's your destruction of Barad-dûr. Where when you start doing it through digital particles, you're choreographing every little piece that's sort of coming off, you know, to get it exactly where you want it.
And although I would have liked to have seen it done as a miniature, I think in the long run, in the good of the picture, I think it's the right thing was done. Now, of course, the ground has to collapse, and all these orcs have to fall in. Of course, everything outside the back of it is digital. And then the whole ground plane is digital also.
So these shots of the destruction of the Black Gate, we completely rebuilt the digital version of the Black Gates from the miniatures to do it. This shot of Mount Doom exploding, same thing. That's a digital version of the mountain that gets exploded. So there's the pyroclastic flow from the fire and the smoke and digital pieces of the volcano blasting off.
Here comes an interesting shot as the plinth, which is the thing that the guys have been standing on inside the Track of Doom, begins to collapse. To do that, we cut it into sections, and each piece is flown separately as if it were a flying miniature, so that, in effect, all the pieces would be docked to make the complete plinth, but then each piece could fall by itself, and each piece could have its own performance. Here's a foreground, live foreground, and a miniature background. Now, these flying lava bombs, this is something that Scott Heron dreamed up. It's a brilliant idea. You take regular old charcoal briquettes, and you put them into a wire mesh basket and light them off, and then fire them with a catapult. And the effect is that it produces a beautiful train of flames and sparks, and then when it hits, it explodes in a blast of sparks.
And it gave you these amazing explosions.
This is a brilliant idea, because instead of having to animate these flaming fireballs, you actually have them on film. You can shoot them to order, coming towards camera, going away from camera. And as you notice, they used them very extensively. That was a stroke of genius to think of doing that. So a lot of that research was done when we were doing the fire effects for the Gandalf fighting the Balrog for film two.
I can see the shot.
Watching a movie like this, you really discover, you know, like it's like in the encyclopedia when you go to the anatomy section and there's little plastic pages, you know, the one is the muscles, one is the skeleton. Every shot in this movie, to some extent or another, is essentially six or seven layers of stuff, you know, laying on top of each other to make up a single frame of imagery.
Rosie Cobb dancing. She had ribbons in her hair.
Friday, busy sort of seeing things and bringing memories back, flooding back to him, but he'd sort of forgotten about Sam to a certain degree. And then when he heard Sam sort of saying,
Dancing with Rosie Cotton,
that he suddenly thought, oh, Sam's here with me. He's actually, they've done it together. And you know, you look at that shot
and Sam actually
on Frodo's face there.
Sam actually had more to lose than Frodo.
Yeah.
Glad to be with you, Sam.
They actually end up being a scene cut quite simply. It was on the huge amounts of cuts in the scene, but it was such a strong the emotion of the characters was driving the scene, and you didn't have to have a lot of cuts. You could hold on shots for a long time. And that lovely fade to black there. Peter felt you needed to have time to sort of take it all in and just sort of get back into thinking about it in a different frame, you know. You had that moment pause to sort of reflect.
When Peter hired John Howe and Alan Lee, they came out and John had just completed a painting of the Eagles saving Frodo and Sam. And Pete just thought it was, you know, such a great image. And when we storyboarded it, he based it on John's painting, and obviously the feel of the shot on the film is, you know, very evocative of that.
These shots would have been storyboarded, and then once the elements were shot and turned over to us, Peter and Jamie would look at the selects they want and pick them and then hand them over to us. We would have worked with Alan and Jeremy to come up with what the appropriate backgrounds were, which direction we were looking, coming up with elements that we could use for the sky and that sort of thing. And then those would get turned over to the compositors and the matte painters to come up with the various elements and then reassembled.
And I remember Peter always said, that was really the end of the movie. That was the end of The Return of the King, whether it's the theatrical version or the extended cut version. And now we enter into essentially coda. You know, that this, you know, what transpires from the Eagles through to the very end of the movie was essentially a succession of coda beats. Which I think, you know, one has earned the right to after, you know, three films and
This journey, I think the audience clearly cares about these characters and wants this.
It's a bit like Spike Jonze's laughing song, isn't it? Do you remember that from when you were a kid?
This thing? Yes. Right. Well, there were different ways of playing them, of course. We didn't have them laughing. There were little smiles, weren't there, at one stage. Mm. It was a choice of either going more for a smile or for a bit of laughter. But it was fairly difficult just to get all this stuff to work, because we obviously had to keep tab on the scale aspects of it as well.
Mm. Pete basically shot the drama between Frodo and Gandalf and bringing in the hobbits, And then we basically just shot a quick little blue screen shot with the other heroes walking into frame into the right mark so that Weta could then comp the two together and get the scale correctly.
All of it was shot in slow-mo, and we actually sped every take up so that the scene would actually get a bit of a move along.
Eventually, we tried all that, but it didn't seem to quite look right because it seemed that the process of speeding it up made it look a bit jittery. It wasn't smooth enough, so Pete was very keen to get it back into slow-mo, so we ended up just reducing it down and just getting the characters in as quick as we could to push the scene along. Because one of those sort of scenes that was sort of, yeah, I felt probably a little bit unnecessary. It was just bringing the Fellowship back together again. The main reason for it really was to bring Gandalf back into the picture for Frodo.
Recognize this shot? This is, it looks like the shot where Denethor falls off the end of the prow, except it's going the other direction. And the very first shot that we did on Minas Tirith, the city is tilted 30 degrees forward, so we get the camera high enough. The wedding scene is the very first shot that we did on Minas Tirith, the very first one.
Well, this is another set that we had built, but we rebuilt for this pickup.
There's a few little pickup shots done here of Gandalf to make
the scene. I can never forget Gandalf in that gorgeous wig with the pink flowers in it.
That was a lovely take they did as a gag take.
Shot on his last day of filming.
Yeah, he had flowers in his hair, and I forget exactly how that went.
It was his last shot they were doing. He went off to have his makeup and hair checked, and he came back on, and he had this beautiful, curled-up white wig
with
on
flowers it. Stuck in it.
Flowers stuck all over.
The point of view of Aragorn looking down the avenue with the guards on either side, we shot that with replicating about 40 extras. So if you actually stop and freeze frame it, you see the same extras scattered on, you know, four times on both sides of the crowd. Yeah. But we did hat swaps and wig swaps and, you know, and all that to kind of try and break it up as much as we could.
The crowd at the base of Aragorn here was clapping and celebrating in his coronation. It was a great opportunity for a lot of the crew to have little cameos as extras.
In this shot right here, Chris Hanna, who is our art department coordinator, and next to her is Claire Raskind, who was our publicist on the film. So it was kind of cool to get them both in this nice shot.
And anyone who works in a cafe in Wellington has been an extra in The Lord of the Rings.
When we were planning the sequence out, Viggo very much wanted to sing this ode that comes from Tolkien. And so that's how this particular song ends up in the film.
It's really a measure of Howard's expertise, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it was actually pulled it all together because it was pretty rough on the original shoot. And Howard managed to pull it back into the movie and sort of make it feel a lot more
like an integral part of it.
Part of the scene.
Return of the King was many films in one, and everything after the destruction of the ring and the eagles, you know, saving Frodo and Sam, everything after that to the end is a complete movie production. It certainly was in terms of writing it and the detail in writing that section of it. But it was also a great release. It was a way of culminating the story, a way of resolving all of the thematic material that you had used for hours and hours before that. And Aragorn becoming king, if musically the scenes before that led up to that, you would reference elements of that. You would reference elements of Gondor and the Fellowship theme and Eowyn and Arwen in that scene. You know, all little fragments of pieces. And of course, it would feel right if it was true. Returning to the Shire, the coronation, those are all resolutions of things that have happened before. You could only return to the Shire because you had had the Shire music in Fellowship of the Ring. You had returned to a place that you knew, and the music reflected that, and it felt right.
part of the reason for doing pickups on the scene was originally it was conceived as part of a montage, and you tied up Aragorn and Arwen's character resolution here, and then you saw Gimli in the mines below Helm's Deep, and you saw Legolas in the forest, and Peter realized that they really should have this moment together as a joint celebration, and therefore he wanted to pick up elements to bring all the cast into the sequence.
We're going to pull out away from Minas Tirith and go into the map. So again, this is one of those shots where we had to tilt the set forward so that we could get the camera high enough. And that was, I think, the second shot we did was one of the last shots in the movie.
The map is different than what was used in the last two films, but only slightly. It's essentially the same map. We changed some of the typefaces and sizes and so forth to some of the names, because we're seeing different details of the map than we did before. So Minas Tirith is a little more fleshed out. You know, we're sort of tracing the journey back now from Minas Tirith through where we've been in the last two films and back to the Shire. So it was really just kind of dressing in those areas to make sure that everything read really well to get us back to where we started.
Dermot Crean is part of our family, is a great instrumentalist, soloist. He plays the Irish fiddle and the Hardanger fiddle, principally in the film. And he plays a solo that is just breathtaking. It's one of my favorite moments. The hobbits have returned to the Shire, and they go back to the pub, and Dermot plays this solo that's so breathtaking and so heartbreaking. I love it. The Shire theme relates to the film because it relates to Frodo and Sam, and you could write the pieces because you could take it down to a small area. It could just be a glance. It could just be the way Frodo looks at Sam. You could write the music based on that, because it's just pure emotion. You're just writing from an emotional response to the characters. And it has to do with their performances and the way they move in those characters. But there's certain expressions that the actors brought to it, and that music is written and created around that expression, and then expanded enormously through the film.
And the hero gets the girl.
One question that Pete was asked was, well, should there be a minister? But one idea that was knocked around was that Alan Lee would do a cameo as the minister, and it was even talked that he would be this sort of, he would be Tom Bombadil as the minister.
And I remember Fran and Peter talking about this business of they're sort of isolated from the rest of Hobbiton now because of the experiences that they've had, and they can't actually talk to the others. Mm. And they were quite consciously thinking about the experience of people who come back from a war, and there is no way that they can talk to their companions who are still at home about it. Do you remember when I first started work on this, you took me on a tour of Bag End, and I walked in the door of Bag End, and it was the most beautiful place I had ever been in. It was magical. I love the entry into the scene.
Yeah. There was another alternative way of getting into it, which we eliminated, a chopper shot that tracked right across Hobbiton and went right up to the door. Didn't really give you any more, so we eliminated that and just went straight through to the from Frodo's face into the hallway.
An exact mirror image of the opening of Fellowship of the Ring, except now it's Frodo, not Bilbo.
So a lot of people, you know, have passed comment that the film The Return of the King takes a long time to end. What is But I think it's completely fitting. You're finishing a story that is three films long. You're not just finishing one film, you're finishing three. And to not give it that time and that attention, I think would have been a sort of a disservice to the epic story that's been told.
I can remember one of the most sort of emotional days on set was, it seemed like they almost like saved the shot for the very last thing for Elijah to shoot, was to be back sitting at that desk writing the last few things in the book and actually closing the book. And when Pete finally reviewed that final take and said, you know, check it, telling the camera department to check to make sure it was good, there was just this total silence. And then they said, yep, okay, the take was good. You know, Pete got up, went over to Elijah. You couldn't tell what they were saying, but they were just sort of talking and hugging each other and stuff. And it was just, it was kind of at that point where it really began to solidify in everyone else that after 6 or 7 or 8 years, however long a lot of these people worked on things, it was finally going to be over.
It was a momentous moment to say goodbye to Frodo, and which was really the end of this long, long journey, symbolically for all of us.
We had some gorgeous illustrations of the Grey Havens that Alan had done. It was one of the most beautiful set of paintings I've ever seen. And we knew that this was going to be a very important moment in the film. It's kind of, again, a visual exclamation point. It's an ending.
Grey Havens was really difficult sequence to come together. It was a beautiful sequence, and of course it needed to be. The miniature was fantastic.
There's a background where only just this little bit of courtyard is built, and everything else is one of a shot of the miniature, matched in.
Well, Jesus.
Now we cut to a beautiful over-shoulder shot, revealing the whole vista, looking out to sea. The water is real water, shot at one of our local harbors, and everything else that you see is pretty much miniature. Just the foreground guys on a bit of blue screen. It was very interesting to see the set, which is the last really big miniature that was built by the Weta Workshop, and to see how mature the style had become, looking back at, let's say, the Caverns of Isengard or Helm's Deep, how the style had matured, the technique, the use of materials, the level of detail. It was a revelation to see how the guys had adapted to our way of working and the stylistic way that that Peter was using these shots.
The movies are bloody good.
Are really good.
I mean, the movies, one thing that all of us that basically knew the books really, really well wondered was how the hell you could get such a complicated, multi-threaded story into a film that actually made sense. And, of course, that was the challenge that drove, you know, Peter, Fran and Philippa just around the bend, was actually maintaining the integrity of the story, but knowing what was actually superfluous and could be pruned without actually offending the fans. Like, for instance, when Tom Bombadil wasn't in the first film, even the purists understood why Tom Bombadil wasn't in the first, because it was a whole other place with a whole other character that you never see again, that you really didn't need. And also, I think the way that they truncated the timeline of the books was also very clever and had to happen for the films. And I've spoken to many, many fans who have seen the films, and they're all really amazed at how well the translation was made from book to film.
This was based on a book?
In terms of fantasy films, it's sort of like, to me, which was one of my favorite films, was 2001. And it's sort of what 2001 did to science fiction films of the 50s, this is doing to fantasy films of the past, you know. And so we're sort of at that time, I think, in terms of fantasy and being able to bring that to the world and say, well, here's a milestone in this type of film genre, you know.
A lot of it really does come from people trying things. I always try to establish guidelines so the people are working towards the same thing. but you're still always waiting for that moment of inspiration where someone is taking all the things that you're saying, this is what needs to be in there to make it really work, and then kind of finding the extra bit that's really going to make it become something special.
This was a very tough scene, obviously, to shoot. You know, it's incredibly emotional. And the real tragedy for us when we were doing this in principal photography was that basically it was shot, and then at Daly's, it was realized, just before Daly's, the lab, there was a problem with the film. And
we had a focus problem in it.
That's right, we did. Yeah. It was quite a big focus problem in it. Peter was so upset about it. He had sort of seen this stuff on the dailies, and it was all soft and was going in and out of focus, and it was excellent performances. It was just a shame. And then it was reshot, but when we
had to go back, and Pete had to go back to the guys and go, look, you know, sorry, but we're going to have to reshoot this.
But he told them while they were in costume, because even knowing that would make them cry, right? So he figured, no. You better be rolling film when you tell them, Pete, no. Because that's but the I best mean, cry you're going to see.
I just think, you know, when I see that scene, I just always think, like, these guys, like, they went back to that same place. They went back there, and they dug deep and got us this great performance again, you know, and
I guess they're good actors.
Yeah, they're great actors. But, you know, that must have been a tough thing for Pete to have to go back to them on, and it's, you know, not an easy thing for them to go back there emotionally, but they did a wonderful job.
Between the two different shoots, we put the scene together. There's some new shoots, some new shots, and some old shots in here.
It's really interesting, isn't it, trying to match the performance level between an original shoot and a pickup shoot, if they haven't necessarily been shot because of performance level. And pulling them together was really quite difficult.
In grading the sequence, I remember we wrestled a lot with Frodo's complexion, because intentionally during photography we had made him up to look very sickly, and then we realized in post-production that was not the wisest decision, and so we wrestled with making him look better when we went to grade the film. And it's another example of how great digital grading was for us, because you could actually go in and grade that portion of the frame only and then track it across the sequence. I remember distinctly the water. See that little element of water in the background with the sun coming down? We shot that element very late in the game. And finding a piece of sea that we could get that aspect with the setting sun was a time-consuming search. And that was Dean and Jim, I think. And God knows how we finally got that shot.
Well, there's another ending coming up. If we sail off into the sunset.
No such luck,
we go to white. And we have to have the final trip back to Hobbiton for the final line from Sam, which I think is good, because it is the last line he says in the book, so you needed to have it.
About this point, especially with the extended version, the audience's bum has gone completely numb. They can't actually feel their feet. They're A, dying of thirst, and B, busting for a pee. So it's a very happy moment for all of us, I think, at this point.
And to be and to do. And that's Sean Astin's real daughter, Allie.
You know, there's a certain gratification that in this time of the world where so many forces would like to push us to the extreme for their own political ends, the world seems to embrace the lives of the Shire. And if we contributed to that in some way, that's a great accomplishment. Very late in the game this year, Peter actually came up to me and said, you know, it would be really nice to do something special for titles on film 3. It's the end of the trilogy.
And not have the same, you know, wide over black that we had had. And we'd play with a few different ideas, and one idea was actually to have just a brief cycle of footage for each of the actors.
After deliberating a couple of different approaches, we approached Alan Lee, and he came up with these wonderful title designs and portraits of the cast that I think are just remarkable, and I really love what we did here.
And I just think it looks really classy, and to me, you know, evokes what we've just been watching. You know, it just has this great kind of you know, wondrous feeling to it all.
When we started working on Return of the King, we made a list of artists, Fran and I did, of who we would love to work with, you know, who we thought would be a great voice for the film. And it was an important moment because it had to carry the weight of the whole trilogy. So that's how Annie became involved. And then Fran and I collaborated with her in the writing of the song, and she, of course, sang it amazingly, and that's how that grew. Writing Into the West with Fran, we wanted the song to feel that it belonged in the Shire. It had a simplicity of the Shire. And it was just thinking like that, because the end of the movie is about Frodo, and it is about the Shire, and it does end in the Shire. It's where you're left, you know, in the last scene. So it's somewhat a Shire Grey Havens. It's kind of, the song is, to me, is Frodo, but there's a bit of Sam in it as well. And it was an expression of that, really.
For me, I think one of the sort of the unique things about this project is the fact that it's involved so many people who have made such a huge commitment in terms of uprooting their lives from various parts of the world and moving here and basically committing such a huge part of their lives to this project.
When I came out here, I was sort of taking this leap of faith to move my family down to New Zealand, thinking I was going to have you know, a great year's vacation in New Zealand, and you know, if the film doesn't work, it'll just be a great holiday. And within the first morning, I was sort of turned around completely. Just the quality they had was, at that time, mind-blowing even to see, because I saw a lot of the work that was done here at Weta Digital, just in terms of the sort of the pre-visualization and building, you know, assets, suits of armor, and building the digital doubles and everything, and then being able to see a real rough cut of the film. But you could see the most important part was there, which was the story. When I first met with Peter, he said, this is a fantasy film, but everywhere we go in this fantasy world has to be absolutely real.
From Peter's point of view, fantasy doesn't have to wink at the audience and say it's only kidding. It can be dead serious. And I think that's one of the things that, aside from all his other attributes, sets him apart from a lot of contemporary directors in making this kind of picture, is that he takes it totally seriously. And damn it, the audience is going to do it too, you know? Mm-hmm. And the audience appreciates that, because they want to believe as much as the picture maker wants them to believe.
Well, for my part, I think it's just been an amazing experience working on it. I don't know, it's going to probably take a while for it to get out of your system.
Yeah, it's a bizarre feeling. I don't really know what I'm going to do now. The Lord of the Rings has been my life for, you know, nigh on sort of 7 years. Originally, the first storyboards that I did with Peter were in August of 1997. And the last work I did was directing one of the effects units in October of 2003. And sort of these reminders that you have doing the DVD commentaries just sort of freshen up in your head what an amazing experience you know, it was to be involved. And it was kind of a bittersweet feeling to sort of finally be at the end of The Lord of the Rings.
I really haven't come to terms with the fact that the movie's over, other than to feel a sense of joy of having participated in this great undertaking.
This never is over. We'll be doing another DVD edition.
That's right.
And then
the 25th year anniversary.
Yeah, that's right. You bet.
With even more footage. Even more eagles.
Yeah.
It's just a great, fun release for me, and I also feel that after all these years, where you're happy that you've finished, that you've completed this task that you set out for, that there is a bit of a postpartum feeling to it.
I find myself very Frodo-like, frankly, at this moment. I think that You know, like the film has created careers. It has it's buoyed the power and economic success of a studio, and millions of people around the world are thrilled and enriched because the films came to be, and yet there's still a melancholy feeling to it all, I think, you know, letting it go. And yet on the other hand, I'm frankly glad to let it go. I actually, you know, as much as it's been great and wonderful, it has extracted a heavy cost, and I would pay the cost again, but I had no idea, you know, how much pain could be endured in the making of a movie. I never cried over film business stuff until The Lord of the Rings. Within my body and spirit, I know for a fact that I have not recovered and won't for years. You know, there's just no chance, because, you know, the film puts you under a crucible of pressure that's not, you know, which is not normal even by big budget Hollywood movie standards. That is really, you know, you really have to learn to operate in a bizarre environment where pressure, you know, it's like I always used to joke, don't come too close to me because the gravitational forces that are acting on me are closer to those of what's like Mars or Jupiter, so if you get too close you might actually get crushed by the gravitational forces. And I used to be 6.5 feet tall, and now I'm being shrunk down to hobbit size.
Those tensions that you had during the course of making the film were relentless. They were absolutely relentless. Every time that you neared the end of the film, the pressure just amped up tremendously, and then immediately you couldn't celebrate the delivery of the film and the conclusion of the film. You actually had, your mind was already engaged fully in what the challenges were in completing the next film.
I mean, this will never happen again in New Zealand, this sort of project.
I don't think it'll happen anywhere.
No.
I don't think anybody will be
silly enough to do three films back to back.
Thank you, Jamie. Yeah.
I don't think it could have been done in America.
When you consider doing it in New Zealand, you've got a very small country, and you've got crews of basically Kiwis, and we all have that same sort of work ethic. We don't have unions, not the hardcore tight union structure at all, but what we do have is this work ethic of, if somebody needs to do it, do it. And
yes,
if a light needs shifting, and you know, and the DOP is busy somewhere else, then and he yells out to you, then whoever's closest shifts it.
I mean, that would never happen anywhere else.
Yeah.
Where people are just all pitching and helping, you know. Mm. I think that was where it's probably exactly what you're right, Annie. It's really, it's just the way we work over here has made it easier to make this sort of production.
You know, like anything, ultimately, it comes down to the people, and the people have really made working on these films, you know, just an experience I can't ever imagine equaling. Everybody basically put their heart and soul into it, and really went out of their way also to try to make, you know, the whole experience a fun one. Because in the end, it was like a family. You know, that's how this was different than normal films. And, you know, I'll miss all those folks. And so thanks to everyone for that, you know, for making it such a great experience.
And like in any family experience, there are moments of ecstasy and joy, and there are moments of pain and controversy, and all of the tough things seem to fade away, and actually you feel this joy at having done it and shared this experience with these people. And I sincerely believe that most of them will be my friends for forever.
Went through hell, battled evil, and at the end, all is right with the world.
That's our story in a nutshell.
Thank you, Peter, for letting me be a part of this wonderful project. Thank you, all the viewers, for watching and listening.
This is Jim Riegel. Thanks for bearing with us for the last 4 hours here.
This is Randy Cook, seconding that.
This is Alex Funky, signing off.
This is Joe Luteri. Thanks for watching. And good night.
This is Rick. Thanks a bunch for listening to us. Hopefully we weren't too tedious.
This is Christian. Thanks a lot for watching and listening to all the information, useful, some useful, some not, that we had to offer.
And this is Brian. Thanks also for watching. I can't wait for the book to come out.